we're really seeing now opening the spigot in Cook Inlet, and we're essentially giving away our resource.
The rush to develop oil and gas in Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an idea to help shrink the state's unfunded pension liability.
One way you could look at this bill is that it's a loan to the retirement system and that we get our money back.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A report detailing prosecutorial misconduct during the Ted Stevens case will be made public. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan ordered today that the 500-page report into the Justice Department's botched corruption case against Stevens be released on March 15th. The special prosecutor who investigated the case did not recommend criminal charges against any of the federal prosecutors, despite finding widespread misconduct, at least some of it intentional. In 2008, a jury convicted Stevens of lying on financial disclosure documents to hide hundreds of thousands of dollars in home renovations and gifts from wealthy friends. A few days later, Stevens lost re-election to the seat he'd held for 40 years. Sullivan dismissed the conviction after the Justice Department admitted misconduct in the case, including withholding from the defense evidence favorable to Stevens. He wrote, "The government's ill-gotten verdict in the case not only cost that public official his bid for re-election, the results of that election tipped the balance of power in the United States Senate." Today, the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments on the Point Thompson case, which could be critical for the future prospects of a natural gas pipeline and for the state's ability to compel oil and gas leaseholders to produce. APRN's Steve Heimel was there.
You can understand much about the Point Thompson case by looking at a map. A pipeline stretches from the nation's richest oil field at Prudhoe Bay, halfway to what some think may be its next richest oil field on the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But in between is a difficult part of the oil patch. The pipeline was built for BP's Badami field, but that field is problematical. The oil is thick and the wells have not produced very well. BP only fills the pipeline in warm weather. Extending the pipeline, however, would reach Point Thompson, right on the edge of the Arctic Refuge and full of an estimated 8 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. ExxonMobil has sat on leases there since 1977. The other important piece of the puzzle is the fact that the gas supply is needed to make a large diameter pipeline economical. And so in 2006, Governor Frank Murkowski's Natural Resources Commissioner Mike Menge decided to force Exxon to act by moving to take away its leases for non-performance. Governor Sarah Palin's Commissioner Mike Irwin repeated that act in 2008, invoking a little-used part of Exxon's lease terms, Section 21. He took the leases away, and Exxon went to court. Exxon also started investing in drilling on the leases. A couple of years ago, State Judge Sharon Gleason ruled partially in Exxon's favor, saying the state violated due process in revoking the leases. Then she stayed her decision until the Supreme Court decided a few things. And that was what was argued in a very public session in front of the West High School auditorium full of students and interested oil industry employees and tons of lawyers, plus a few reporters. The court has not said when it will rule. There are two basic points. Was Exxon entitled to a hearing before losing the leases, and did the state spread its lawyers too thin, using them for both adjudicating and advising, creating a conflict that biased the decision against Exxon? Exxon argues that the field is not economical without a gas pipeline, and the state argues something else can still be produced. Whatever happens goes back to Judge Gleason, along with other aspects of the case. Meanwhile, Exxon is proceeding with its activity to develop natural gas liquids at Point Thompson, and the state still does not know if it has the authority to revoke leases for non-performance through Section 21. So it may matter a lot, or maybe not so much. Answering questions from the students after the arguments, attorneys for both sides said if the state did get the Point Thompson leases back and put them out for bid again, ExxonMobil might easily be the winning bidder again. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
High energy prices, new technology, and a favorable business climate are all contributing factors to a resurgence of natural resource development along the Cook Inlet. However, the race to get to those untold quantities of oil and gas has led to what some are calling a Wild West mentality among developers. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Last October, Houston-based Escapeda Oil was fined $15 million for violation of the Jones Act when they had their Spartan 151 jackup rig towed to Alaska by a Chinese vessel without a waiver from the Department of Homeland Security. A waiver from the Jones Act is what allowed a Russian fuel tanker to make a winter delivery to Nome earlier this year, and typically is only granted when issues of national security are at stake.
Escapeda has always had this Wild West mentality, and when they sought to bring the rig up here, they intentionally broke a federal law that was designed to support U.S. jobs and shipbuilders, and the jackpot was a $25 million tax credit. So even with a $15 million fine, they're still going to come out ahead. So it really does set a dangerous precedent if Escapeda can prove that it pays to violate federal law.
That's Bob Shavelson, Director of Advocacy for the Cook Inlet Keeper Organization. He says this particular case shows that sometimes it pays to violate laws already on the books if the incentives are high enough. In this case, the state of Alaska put a $25 million tax credit up for grabs, so even with the fine, Escapeda still stands to pull in $10 million from the operation. Escapeda representatives could not be reached for comment for this story, but Bruce Webb, a vice president for the company, was quoted in a November story by Reuters saying, quote, "We rolled the dice and took the chance. It didn't work out, so now we're subject to the penalty." Jim Watt is the president and chief operating officer of Buccaneer Alaska, a company that has already done a lot of work both on and offshore along the inlet. He says everything about the current climate means expanded exploration is good for business.
The commodity prices, both for oil and gas, are now very attractive for explorers to come in the basin, as well as the incentives that the state of Alaska has put forth through their ACES program. And you couple that with the fact that the basin's been underexplored. Indeed, the basin's going to see a lot more activity given the technology advances and the fact that it still is a fairly underexplored basin.
Shavelson says he recognizes the importance of resource development, but questions just how much thought companies are putting into the future of Alaska's economy and natural resources.
Well, certainly the oil and gas industry has been vitally important for the local economy and for jobs in this area, but you know, we're really seeing now opening the spigot in Cook Inlet, and we're essentially giving away our resource. So we have to make a decision here. Are we going to have some of these resources left for future generation, or are we just going to be pigs at the trough and consume them all right now?
And just how much gas and oil is down there anyway? In the Reuters story, Escapeda estimated 3.5 trillion cubic feet of in-place reserves of natural gas. That's an impressive number, and according to Commissioner Dan Seamount of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, certainly a probable number.
There is 70 billion to 140 billion barrels of oil that has not been accounted for. And where is that? Waiting to be found.
So while no one can deny either the importance or the vast quantity of potential energy reserves in the Cook Inlet, the most responsible way to go about producing them is still up for debate. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Yukon Quest mushers talk strategy near the race halfway point.
If you run too hard and get a dog or too hurt in the process, then goal's not worth it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The state could save more than $5 billion in future payments to the Alaska Public Employees Retirement System by immediately putting $2 billion into a pension reserve fund, according to legislative fiscal analyst David Teal. Over the past 5 years, the state has contributed about $1 billion to the retirement system, which has an unfunded liability estimated at $11 billion. Teal told the Senate Finance Committee today that if nothing is done, yearly payments in the millions of dollars will continue through at least 2030.
If we were to contribute an additional $2 billion now, it would allow us to stop making state assistance payments in the future. Another way to look at it is the cumulative contributions without a deposit would be $8.3 billion. Well, the cumulative contributions with the $2 billion deposit are three, for a savings of $5.3 billion over the life of this model.
Senate Bill 187, sponsored by the Finance Committee, would set up the $2 billion reserve fund, which could be used to supplement PERS as needed. The money would come from state savings, which currently total more than $10 billion. Because the fund would be separate from the retirement system, Teal says the state could eventually get its money back once the PERS deficit disappears. But he says that won't be for several years.
One way you could look at this bill is that it's a loan to the retirement system and that we get our money back, but it's a very long-term loan. You're not talking about 10 years and you get your money back. You're talking about somewhere out there in 2050 or 2060.
That prompted this question from Sitka Republican and Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman.
Mr. Teal, do you plan on being here to make sure we get our money back?
I plan on getting my own money out by then, Mr. Chairman.
This was the first hearing for the bill, which was set aside for further review. Stedman said the committee will take public comment at the next hearing. The amount municipalities pay into the retirement system is currently capped at 22% of their payroll. Under SB 187, that number would stay the same. Governor Sean Parnell has said he's opposed to the idea of creating a reserve fund to help supplement PERS. The governor says he'd rather not create another pile of money that's off limits in case of an emergency. Several Alaska Native organizations oppose parts of a legislative measure backing more sea otter harvests, but they support efforts to get Alaskans more involved in federal management of the once-rare marine mammals. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sea otters were almost wiped out by Russian and American hunters, but they've been reintroduced to southeast and are expanding in number and range. Crabbers and divers say the voracious animals are decimating populations of crab and other shellfish they gather for commercial or subsistence use. Alaska Natives are allowed to hunt otters but face strict federal limits on how they are used. Full pelts can be sold to other natives. Traditional products, such as clothing or regalia, can be sold to anyone. Representative Peggy Wilson, a Wrangell Republican, authored the legislative resolution asking federal authorities to work with state and native leaders to allow more hunts.
We're hoping that the natives can do what they traditionally have done for years and that they can be able to harvest them, use their skins to make other things so that they can make money. And if we just keep it to them, we're not going to over-harvest by any means of the imagination.
Wilson's resolution supports allowing whole pelts to be sold to non-natives, which is now illegal. She recently told the House Resources Committee that would boost harvests and lessen impacts on fisheries. Tlingit Haida Central Council President Ed Thomas says the change could create problems.
The biggest threat is that if we were allowed to sell those pelts unaltered, you can pretty much guess if you look down here on South Franklin that they would come back as authentic native crafts made in Taiwan.
Thomas supports other parts of the resolution calling for a new federal management plan that increases otter harvests. So does Rosita Wuerl, who spoke on behalf of the Alaska Federation of Natives, Sea Alaska Corporation, and the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Sea Alaska and tribal governments in Sitka and Petersburg are among those trying to expand pelt processing. Wuerl says they're providing training and equipment needed to support a growing cottage industry.
We see sea otters as just one answer to trying to promote sustainable economies in our communities.
She says the current law is interpreted too narrowly. She wants native craftspeople to be able to make and sell a wider variety of otter products, such as teddy bears.
We have a number of our people that have been cited. We've complained vigorously about the enforcement practices. We have advanced ideas of co-management. But our idea really was to change the marine mammal law that would allow for the sale of contemporary items.
House Joint Resolution 26, Wilson's measure, was introduced last year. Its first hearing was February 3rd in the House Resources Committee. It remains before that panel. If passed, it will be sent to Alaska's congressional delegation and the Secretary of the Federal Department of the Interior. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska's U.S. senators have introduced legislation to prevent the Air Force transfer of aircraft from Eielson in North Pole to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski's bill blocks funding for the movement of a 21-jet F-16 fighter squadron. Senator Begich, who sits on the Armed Service Committee, says the measure is aimed at what he calls an unjustified move by the Air Force prior to the start of an upcoming Base Realignment and Closure Commission review.
This is, in my view, kind of an end run by the military trying to figure out how to do a BRAC without going through a process of BRAC. And we think this is, again, the inappropriate way to do it. And this argument is the same argument they used in 05, that it would save money. At the end of the day, they found it would not save money. So we're going to put the questions hard to them. We're going to fight hard to keep Eielson fully stocked with the F-16s. We think it's important.
During a BRAC round in 2005, Eielson was downsized but spared the loss of the F-16s, a move which would include the transfer of thousands of personnel to Anchorage. Senator Murkowski says it was just a week ago that the Air Force petitioned Congress for permission to pursue BRAC rounds in 2013 and 2015.
Then, literally within the next series of days, the Air Force makes this announcement that they're going to be moving not only assets such as the F-16, but retiring certain aircraft, four C-130s out of Elmendorf, all before any analysis, any study, any assessment as to the impact. They say it's all about cost savings, but we've been through this exercise before.
Begich says the Eielson move is one of many proposed for Air Force bases around the country to save money.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates four decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Emergency responders are getting some practice this week in responding to a statewide disaster in Alaska. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports on how Alaska Shield 2012 could lead to improved response in the event of a real-world disaster.
Media organizations across Alaska, including this radio station, received an alarming message early Monday morning. In emails marked cold weather warning, emergency management offices notified local media and emergency responders that, quote, life-threatening cold weather had come into south-central Alaska and would last for 7 to 10 days. Luckily, the messages were also clearly marked with the word exercise and came with an explanation that the life-threatening cold weather was just part of Alaska Shield 2012. Jeremy Zidek is public information officer for the state's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says Alaska Shield is a biennial emergency preparedness exercise. It's meant to test the emergency response of the state of Alaska and various communities statewide.
This year, in 2012, we're testing our cold weather response. So it's an opportunity for community emergency management staffs to stand up their incident management teams, communicate with the state, determine what they need, and then in the exercise, the state will try to figure out ways to meet those needs.
Seven communities across the state are participating in the week-long exercise: the Kenai Peninsula, Anchorage, Matsu, Fairbanks, Kodiak, Juneau, and Unalaska. Cordova and Valdez were originally scheduled to take part, says Zidek, but folks in those towns decided they'd had enough real-world emergency response after experiencing record snowfalls last month.
They decided to bow out after going through 2 weeks of real response, but these are realistic scenarios. Alaskan communities all across the state do face severe weather, and it's good to practice both within the community, but also to practice with that interaction with the state.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough also had a taste of real-world emergency response in November when a pair of powerful windstorms knocked out power for thousands of people. President Barack Obama approved a disaster declaration for those storms just last week. Still, the borough is participating in Alaska Shield 2012 by opening its Emergency Operations Center in Soldotna. That's according to Borough Public Information Officer Julie Sisko.
And ultimately, if it becomes necessary, if this does escalate into a full-blown real event, the borough would probably get into sheltering, if necessary.
The borough will also be holding a sheltering demonstration, or a community slumber party, as they're billing it. That's Friday and Saturday. They're inviting the community to come spend the night at Soldotna Middle School. In addition to towns and boroughs, NSTAR Natural Gas Company is participating in Alaska Shield 2012. The gas company issued a condition yellow alert Monday that's simulating a gas shortage in south-central Alaska combined with extreme low temperatures. A condition yellow alert calls on gas customers to turn their thermostats down to 65 degrees in living areas and 40 degrees in garages and other areas. Alaska Shield 2012 will continue through Sunday. Jeremy Zidek says the next Alaska Shield exercise in 2014 will combine scenarios from the last two exercises, testing responders in the event of a major earthquake combined with extreme cold weather. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The first musher to the race halfway point at Dawson City is expected tonight. Mushers have been out of touch on the remote 150-mile stretch of trail between Eagle and Dawson since last night, when four-time champ Lance Mackey led Hugh Neff, Alan Moore, Brent Sass, Jake Berkowitz, and Sonny Lindner out of the checkpoint. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports on what the Yukon Quest frontrunners were thinking in Eagle.
Lance Mackey spent the early part of the race holding back what he says is an inexperienced puppy team. But just when his competitors thought he was behind them, Mackey pulled his team, made up predominantly of two-year-old Huskies, into the Eagle checkpoint in the number one spot. He passed seven other teams on the way.
It's always nice to go hunting, not be the hunted.
Mackey doesn't believe in maxing out his dogs early, but he may never be able to give up the thrill of the chase.
At this point, I'm in a perfect position. That don't mean I'm going to get the gold. That doesn't mean I'm going to win the race. I'm setting them up. I'm setting them up for a foot race, basically. You're not going to outrun Hugh or Brandt or any of these other guys by a long time. They know my style. They're ready to counteract, you know what I mean? So I'm not going to lose any of them. So I might as well run a smart race instead of just a off-the-cuff, kind of winging it race, you know?
The outcome is still 600 miles down trail in this year's Yukon Quest, but the first musher that reaches Dawson City wins a 4-ounce bag of gold nuggets, which raises the question, is it worth racing to Dawson from Eagle for gold?
I mean, obviously, it's worth having the gold.
Veteran musher Sonny Lindner was heating up water for his dog team as he pondered the question.
But I don't think if you're not ready, you should go with that solely in mind and drive your team just to pick up some gold, because that's not why we're all out here. I remember for a while, nobody that got the gold won the race, so that probably said something.
Lance Mackey and Hugh Neff spent most of their mandatory layover at Eagle eyeing each other's every move. The two joked about a trip to the casino in Dawson as they downed burritos and Tang. But after a short rest, they rushed to pull their boots back on, stumbling around one another for their mittens and hats. By the time teams reach Eagle, mushers have fleshed out their race plans, and it's starting to show. But they don't often make those plans public, and if they are speaking openly about their strategy, it's likely only partly true. UNEF says he doesn't care much about the gold poke, but he still left the checkpoint within 2 minutes of his competition.
Whether I get it or not, really no big deal. I mean, I won gold in 2005, and I still haven't done anything with it.
But Neff, who says he always likes to stay out in front of the pack, appears eager to arrive in Dawson first.
You know, I would like to get there in as timely a manner as possible. If they're looking good, then, you know, here we come.
Early on, Brent Sass found himself in the lead. He says it was an uncomfortable and unintentional position for his team. He isn't concerned about the gold one bit. He just doesn't want to have to chase down his competitors too hard toward the end of the race.
Not at all. I mean, I'm definitely not racing for the gold. I'm racing to be within striking distance of my competition.
For Sass, striking distance means about 3 or 4 hours.
But, I mean, ultimately 2 hours would be great. But I don't want to burn the dogs out.
Alan Moore is still weighing his options. He says, on the one hand, yes, the gold is worth a race.
But then on the other hand, if you run them too hard and you still got 500 miles of the race to go, you run them too hard and get a dog or two hurt in the process, then gold's not worth it.
A sleep-deprived Moore says he doesn't have a plan for his team as he heads from Eagle to Dawson. But Moore is driving the more competitive of his kennel's two teams in this year's quest. Gold or not, veteran Sonny Lindner says the real racing hasn't even begun.
Yeah, that's next week.
Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Eagle, I'm Emily Schwing.
And finally tonight, a correction in our story on the redistricting court case last night. We said the entire redistricting board is appointed by the governor. The governor does appoint two members of the board, but the presiding officer of the Senate, the presiding officer of the House of Representatives, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court each appoint one member of the board. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.